I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to What General Medical Oncologists Want to Know About Non-Small Cell Lung Cancer. We're going to be talking about targeted therapy. We have an outstanding faculty, Professor Solange Peters, from the Lausanne University Hospital in Lausanne, Switzerland, Dr. Zosia Piotrowska from the Massachusetts General Hospital, and Dr. Greg Riley from Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. We're going to throw up a few yes-no poll questions, spontaneous types of questions as we go through this exercise today. And of course, we sent out a survey to the attendees of this conference, and more than 100 have responded. We're going to show you the results of that as we go through this. If you're into audio programs, we know that a lot of people end up listening to these webinars on replay. Check out our new podcast series, Oncology Today, including a recent program with Dr. Roy Herbst on the use of EGFR, osimertinib in the adjuvant situation, of course, the DORA trial that we're going to talk about in a second. And as for all the programs in this series, I've already met individually with each of the faculty members and recorded an in-depth presentation of the topics related to this. We're going to look at cases. We're really going to make rounds with general medical oncologists, something that we've been doing now since the beginning of the pandemic. These are six general medical oncologists in community-based practice. I've heard cases of myeloma, CLL, bladder cancer from them. We'll sit down with them for an hour. We'll tape 10 or 15 cases to be presented. As I mentioned, we've been doing that now since the beginning of the pandemic, first time we've shown this slide. And actually, since in the last little bit more than a year, about 13 months, we've actually recorded almost 1,200 cases and presented almost 700 of those cases in live webinars. And you can see that lung cancer is our number one with more than 200 cases, but many others from general medical oncology. We're so appreciative that they open up their practices to us and allow us to take a look at the decisions they're making and to provide feedback to them. So based on making rounds with these docs, here's where we're heading, talking about targeted therapy. We're going to start out with a few comments about adjuvant treatment, and then we're going to jump into a bunch of other cases where patients either received or considered targeted therapy. Just want to mention also, I did a webinar on gynecologic cancers and went over this press release. And interestingly, cancer of the cervix is about to go down the same path that lung cancer went through a few years ago. This is a press release of chemo plus IO plus Bev in metastatic cervical cancer, positive trial, including survival. Let's talk about one of the biggest papers that came out, studies that came out, the ADORA study. Before we get into that, Greg, I just want to see what you think about this case. Dr. Padma Malady from Roanoke, Virginia, who again has presented a bunch of cases, said, "Hey, sorry, I know you're doing this thing tonight. Can you ask the faculty, what should I do with this 60-year-old lady? Went for surgery, had a T2A lesion, but also the surgeon found a 2-millimeter pleural nodule with cystic size and actually is the tumor. So this patient technically stage 4A NED. Would have been interesting to talk about whether or not to give osimertinib if this met wasn't present. So Greg, Dr. Malady wants to know, would you give osimertinib and also for how long?
Right. So I think we have the challenge here. We have to ask, what are we aiming to do? Are we aiming to cure this patient, or are we aiming to keep the cancer controlled? And I think, unfortunately, with 4A disease, we're not going to be able to cure this with a TKI. And so when I'm thinking about that, then I think, do I start now or do I wait until the patient's progressed? And I got to say, I probably see a case like this once or twice a year, and it's always a long discussion. I will tell you that if it were me in this spot, I'd probably lean towards holding off on starting osimertinib, but a lot of patients really can't bear that idea and really want to start. So I think either way is a reasonable approach.
Well, let's just find out from the audience. Audience, I want to know, yes or no, would you likely recommend osimertinib to this patient? Greg's saying if it was him, he probably wouldn't want to be treated and just hold off and wait. I'm curious what the audience think. Audience, would you start osimertinib? Yes or no? And we'll see what they have to say. Then I want to ask another question to Zosia. And actually, it looks like three-quarters of the audience disagrees with you. So we're starting out on a good foot here. They all want to give osimertinib to this patient. Here's the ADORA data. You can see in Zosia's presentation. She goes through it beautifully. We're not going to talk about the data. You can check out her presentation. But Zosia, one of the questions that I have that I also want to ask the audience about is based on this. I thought you might find this interesting to take a look at. This is actually an audio program that we did with Sir Richard Pedo and also Dr. Larry Norton on breast cancer. This was a big overview study that came out in 1992. Here's the paper in Lancet. Here's the audio program, Zosia. I don't know if you ever seen one of these, Zosia. This is a cassette tape that we did with this program. But one of the things that came out with that overview, Zosia, because prior to that time, people were only using adjuvant tamoxifen and chemo and breast cancer for node positive, because that was the only statistically significant data. What Pedo showed with this is you saw the same thing with node negative, same hazard rate, just the absolute benefit was later. It took longer to accumulate the events. And of course, the analogy here in terms of ADAURA are the patients who weren't high enough risk to get in the trial. Osimertinib does have, you know, potential toxicities, but, you know, it's not chemotherapy either. So outside of clinical trial, outside of reimbursement, you know, more pure science, Zosia. Well, let's start out. Let's ask the audience. Audience, do you think that patients who were lower risk, stage one, who maybe have, you know, not as much absolute benefit as the patients who went in the trial, do you think these patients, if you could access it, should at least be offered osimertinib, or really should not be offered because it wasn't part of the trial? And Zosia, it looks like there's a consensus in the audience. Just kidding. It's literally 55 to 45%. They're completely split. What do you think, Zosia?
So interestingly, I actually saw a patient like this this week earlier in clinic. And I think, you know, they're actually, when we think about the magnitude of benefit of osimertinib, I think you have to acknowledge that it is less in the early stage patients, even in the 1Bs that were included in the ADAURA trial. And I think, you know, in the setting of a very early stage lung cancer, you know, we're fortunate that cure rates are fairly high. And I think the magnitude of benefit is relatively low. And there, I think the risk benefit conversation about, you know, the downsides and the potential small, but real risk of serious toxicities becomes, I think, important to consider. So, you know, for this patient that I saw in clinic this week, outside of a clinical trial, which we don't currently have, we ultimately decided against it. I think it's a discussion with patients, you know, and risk factors, but I would lean in the no direction in this case.
So Leonard in the chat room brings up the really important point. What about prevention of brain mets by osimertinib? I mean, again, Zosia goes through that in her talk. You know, 10% of the control group brain mets, 1% osimertinib. Even if survival is not different, that's not a good experience, obviously, to have a brain met. So here's another question. One of the reasons we've been able to present more than 200 cases this year, Solange, is we've done so many lung cancer webinars where we presented cases. And this, every single one of those, we ask this question, which is, you've got a patient who could have been in the trial, say it's 2B. And the question is, what are you going to do? This is what the audience says. And this is what they all say. The investigators say chemo followed by osimertinib. That's the evidence base. And yet a quarter of the audience says, these are people with lung cancer, they're older, et cetera. Let's skip the chemo. The hazard rate's not that great, 0.88, et cetera. Solange, what do you think about that? Yes.
So to me, the answer here is absolutely clear. What I mean by that is, first of all, the magnitude of benefit of ADAURA in stage two really warrants that once now we have to consider osimertinib in the adjuvant setting. But what ADAURA was not asking about or questioning was a case of chemotherapy. So chemotherapy was left to the investigators. So this chemotherapy in the trial is somehow not controlled at all at the parameter. And it was not the question of ADAURA. So we shouldn't try to answer a question using a trial if this was not the statistical topic of the trial. So I think we all know that chemo saves life. We still don't know if OSI saves life. We know it prolongs at least the DFS. So I think that if you can, and I answer like the majority, you have to give chemo followed by OSI.
So we're just doing sort of a tasting menu here. We could spend the whole hour just on this topic. But one more question. I'm going to ask the audience about this one as well. So Greg, another memory from the past. This is the so-called IPASS study. Dr. Tony Mock led this in first-line metastatic disease. Actually, not all these people even had EGFR mutations. But of course, when they, particularly when they looked at the EGFR mutant population, it was clear that gefitinib beat chemotherapy. And, you know, later on, we just started, we stopped doing randomized trials. We didn't do a trial like this on RET or a lot of the more recent targeted agents. We just went ahead and applied the IPASS model. If we saw 50, 60% response rate like we did with EGFR, RET, et cetera, we just started using it first line. And I guess my question to you is, what about in the adjuvant setting? Are we going to really wait for an adjuvant RET trial? Are we going to wait for an adjuvant BRAF trial? Just kind of curious whether, you know, outside of trial, the patient says they'll pay for it. Let's ask the audience. Audience, you got a patient with a RET alteration, and would you present the possibility of an adjuvant RET inhibitor in a, let's say, a higher risk patient? If you could get it paid for, would you present that as an option? And Greg, again, it's almost looking like a consensus. Just kidding. 60 versus 40%. So 60% of the audience said they would use an adjuvant RET inhibitor. Greg, what are you thinking?
You know, I think this is exactly the way we're going to go in the future. I think we probably need a little bit more data to get us there. And you know, what I'd say in the metastatic context, we did those randomized chemo versus TKI trials. We did multiple trials like that in EGFR. And then we did trials like that with ALK inhibitors. So we really built up a pretty strong foundation of data saying that TKIs were better than chemo in that context. And so I think we're probably going to have to see a little bit more data like we've seen with ADAURA and extended to at least another oncogene, maybe two, and then we'll be able to apply that more broadly, I think.
All right. So let's go make some rounds with our general medical oncologists. We're going to start out with, I think, a really important teaching case. And again, I'm so appreciative of docs who allow us to really look inside their practices. This is a patient of Dr. Maggie Deutsch, a 67-year-old man, who presented with metastatic disease, very symptomatic, patient wanted to be treated right away. She gets back to PD-1, it's 95%, but she doesn't have back the NGS yet. What do you do? Here's Dr. Deutsch.
He's pretty newly diagnosed. So he's 67, pickleball player, lifelong non-smoker, but both parents were heavy smokers, so he had some exposure. Presented with progressive chest discomfort, shortness of breath. PET scan showed large hypermetabolic left upper lobe mass, extensive hypermetabolic left pleural-based disease and a large left pleural effusion, and some hypermetabolic lymphadenopathy. Biopsy showed adenosquamous carcinoma, PD-1 greater than 95%. He was symptomatic, and I thought he needed to be treated. Also, he's very type A. He wanted, you know, treatment today.
So, Zosia, I'm sure you can think about 10 patients in your practice that you've seen in this situation. What do you typically do in this situation?
It's a really, I think I agree with you. This is a really important point, and this certainly comes up. You know, there are those patients who are asymptomatic, who are anxious to start treatment, but clinically can wait. And then there are the patients like this one who are more symptomatic, and it really doesn't feel clinically appropriate to wait several weeks for the NGS to come back. In those cases, I've often, you know, reached for chemotherapy alone as an initial therapy. So, you know, for a patient with an adenocarcinoma, start them on carboplatin pemetrexed, wait while you're waiting for the NGS to come back. You can hold it during cycle one. And then, you know, once you have that NGS report in hand, you know that they don't have a driver oncogene that you need to switch to targeted therapy for, then add in the immunotherapy with cycle two. And I think that avoids the issue, which is an important one, which is that you start immunotherapy and then find that the patient has a mutation where you want to potentially start a targeted therapy, where we know that risk of many targeted therapies directly after immunotherapy can be that there are higher toxicities, for example, increased risk of pneumonitis with osimertinib. So I think that's one way to minimize that risk.
So yeah, this is a message we've been putting in our programs for quite a while now. And a lot of people are doing this now. Here's what happened with this patient.
I gave him carbo-pem-pem.
Have you ever done the strategy in this situation or similar situations where while you're waiting for the ALK and EGFR and Foundation One, you give chemo without an IO, and then when the foundation all comes back, then you add the IO?
Yes.
What happened with him?
I gave him carbo-pem-pem, and he's done well. He's coming back to see me on Tuesday. Foundation One came back with a ROS1 rearrangement.
Wow.
Yep.
Wow.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Wow.
What are you thinking?
I'm thinking I'm going to put him on targeted therapy. That's a great case. I was like, I saw that Foundation one. I was like, so excited.
Wow. So what do you think you're going to give him?
I'm going to give him entrectinib because I want the CNS coverage. Even though he doesn't have CNS disease, I want the CNS penetration. It's kind of like the osimertinib, erlotinib, you know, kind of discussion. Right. I want the CNS penetration.
So Solange, any thoughts about this case? We were talking about this issue of whether if you give targeted therapy, somebody who's had an IO recently, you know, we've talked about that with osimertinib, but what do we know about other forms of targeted therapy in this phenomena? And also any thoughts about choice of first line treatment in this situation with ROS1?
Well, first of all, we don't have many data with many of the targeted therapy we use usually. It's very often kind of spurious data found because some patients were exposed in the context of clinical trials to IO before. But we have this paradigm of osimertinib, which is strikingly worrisome, right? You should not give osimertinib right after an anti-PD-1 or an anti-PD-L1. However, some of these drugs look like being can be given after IO, and lorlatinib would be one where the toxicity was not observed in the small series we have. So in this patient, I would have considered, for example, lorlatinib. I must say I have no data about entrectinib, and I have no idea about how it would happen, how it would go, if it would be feasible. So that's the kind of the unknowns. So it's true that if you can hold on and try to be precision oncology, to deliver precision oncology, when you know about precision, do you have a driver? Does your PD-L1 count or not? Because if you have a driver, your PD-L1 95% disappears because the driver is the only target you have. So maybe precision oncology is about waiting for precision. In frontline for this patient, right, from many, many places, you have crizotinib frontline for ROS1, but crizotinib doesn't cover the brain, and the brain is a very important site for metastasis in ROS1-2, probably slightly lower, but quite similar to ALK. So if you have access to a new generation TKI, entrectinib or lorlatinib, I would rather favor that the frontline would protect the brain. Because like, as you have said, there's nothing worse for a patient than developing a CNS kind of disease. Would it be only in the feeling it can give to someone to have this constraint and this risk being described by your doctor?
Just a follow-up question to you, Solange. We've heard quite a few cases this past year of people with ALK who got, and we're about to see a case of a patient who got ALK, who, and we're talking about CNS mets, got started on crizotinib, you know, many years ago. They're doing fine, but the docs just get, the patient's totally fine, negative workup, but the docs just getting nervous. Do you ever just switch because of the better coverage in the brain to something like alectinib?
Well, for two reasons. I think in medicine, you have to make a decision and keep your decision as long as you have a good reason to change. The rationale behind is you can choose between sequencing from Criso to a next generation, or you can start with a next generation, but you should not struggle up and forth between both. Both strategies are viable, but you have to pick one. And the other thing is for the patient. The patient must be able to follow your thought. So you should be strong in your decision being made with him and continue the same way. So I would not change. And even if one or two brain mets appear on the crizotinib, I would try to extract the most benefit I can extract from crizotinib, irradiate and continue, and switch to a new generation only at the time I have a secondary resistance mechanism or I have numerous brain mets, for example. But I think you have to hold on, to stay really on your scientific position because it makes sense to you, but also to the clinical data and to the patient.
Greg, just to get back to ALK, and I just want to really focus on these cases today. You can look through the slide deck for some of the survey results and the data. I just want to talk about taking care of patients. You know, it's never as easy on paper when you put up some theoretical case and you start really getting into what happens in the real world. And you all know about that. So here's a really good example. 74-year-old woman who actually presented with a triple negative breast cancer, which she's getting treatment for, chemo and surgery, radiation therapy, and then pops up with a bunch of lung nodules and is found to have, in addition to that, a lung cancer that, as it turns out, has an ALK alteration and has a TMB of 14. So here's Dr. Ray Lobens with his questions about this case.
I did the workup on the lung cancer, and she has the ALK mutation. She has multiple lung lesions that were noted, and she has some axillary lymph nodes. And so I have lots of questions for her. She's getting adjuvant radiation therapy now for her breast cancer, but I also put her on alectinib. Is there any interaction with alectinib and radiation therapy? If she does progress with her breast cancer, is there any data on alectinib treating her lung cancer when I have to use chemotherapies to treat her breast cancer? There's a lot of ALK inhibitors. Which one would they suggest that I use next, or what order I would use the ALK inhibitors for her lung cancer if she progresses with her lung cancer?
So, Greg, you know, again, the challenge of general medical oncology is, you know, maybe they're maybe going to see one ALK case a year, maybe one every 2-3 years, and they got to know what to do. I mean, and there are so many examples of that in general medical oncology, critical decisions that really make a difference to a patient, but they just don't see it that often. Any thoughts about this case, Greg, and some of the questions he has about the interaction with alectinib and chemo, radiation therapy, and the optimal ALK first-line drug, Greg?
Yeah, so I'll jump in first with one thing that strikes me as a little bit odd about the case is the high TMB for this ALK-positive lung cancer. You know, it's very typical that a ALK-positive lung cancer will have a low TMB. Of course, all things happen, and I'm sure that's what happens in this case, but I guess I'm a little anxious about this and worry that the outcomes might not be quite as classic as we often see with patients with ALK-positive lung cancer. But yeah, this real-world scenario where you got to treat two diseases at the same time is a tough one. You know, with regard to ALK plus chemo, we've done that a little bit in lung cancer. There's not a ton of prospective data on ALK inhibitors and chemotherapy combined. One of Dr. Piotrowska's colleagues, Jess Lin, and I published a paper a number of years ago where we reported outcomes of patients who combined chemotherapy, in this case, typically platinum pemetrexed chemotherapy, with alectinib. And in general, it was found to be relatively well tolerated. So I think the combination with chemo is probably not so difficult. There's less data on radiation. In particular, there's very little data on radiation to the breast, but I would presume it's probably not so toxic. And, you know, I think we all understand that doing the curative therapy for breast cancer at the moment is probably a high priority item for this patient.
So, Zosia, what about this issue of first-line therapy of ALK? You know, we saw some exciting data on lorlatinib, but on the other hand, we've been hearing stuff about unusual sort of mental psychiatric complications. Curious what your thoughts are about optimal first-line therapy, abrogatinib, that kind of looks pretty much very similar to alectinib. What's your first-line therapy, and what are your thoughts about these sort of strange things that happen on lorlatinib?
I think, you know, it's almost an abundance of riches, and it's a good problem to have in that we have, you know, several first line trials, you know, showing that brigatinib, alectinib, and lorlatinib are all superior to crizotinib as first line therapy. So, you know, I think they're all reasonable options. Of course, the latest kind of data set was the CROWN trial and lorlatinib. And I mean, I think that data looks very promising. And certainly one of the big advantages of lorlatinib is its excellent CNS penetration. You know, I think my own personal, all of our decisions are colored by personal experience. And, you know, I have had some patients that have had trouble with some of these kind of cognitive mood issues with lorlatinib, which I think when they occur can be a challenge. And, you know, they require careful management. They can require dose holds. And in my experience, they respond well to dose interruption, dose adjustments. But, you know, these can be very, I think, side effects that affect people's moods and sometimes personality can be a challenge. And I think that has to be weighed against the potential benefit. So I think they're all reasonable options. You know, in my ALK patients, since this data came out, I will say I've still favored alectinib as first-line therapy. But I think if you had a patient, particularly with a high CNS burden, I think there could be good rationale to consider lorlatinib.
So, Solange, I want you to respond to this next case. This is a 63-year-old patient, a woman of Dr. Muhammad. This is a patient who has a RET fusion. And here's the case.
She had CT scan of the chest that showed large left upper lobe lung mass, abutting the mediastinum and also involving the anterior chest wall. MRI of the brain showed solitary brain lesion. PD-L1 expression of 0%, but she had red KEF5B fusion. She received SRS to the brain. She received some palliative radiation to the left upper lobe lung mass before starting chemotherapy. We were able to get her in a clinical trial with Dr. Gaynor in Boston, one of the early people on the LOXO-292, which is selpercatinib now. And she has been on treatment for 3 years, no evidence for progression.
Wow. Any tolerability issues with the selpercatinib?
She had few episodes of diarrhea and she has occasional nausea, but in general, she has been tolerating the treatment well.
Any other questions about this case?
If she progresses on selpercatinib, would pralesetinib be considered an option or you just go back to chemo?
So Solange also kind of doing a Sunday morning, we call it quarterbacking, but on this case, you know, this patient actually was treated a couple of years ago, got chemo first and radiation to the brain, SRS to the brain, and then got on the trial selpercatinib. So another question is, if the patient presented today, would you start out with a targeted therapy? We asked the audience how they think through RET rearrangements. And in terms of first-line treatment, most of them say targeted therapy. More people say selpercatinib than pralsetinib. We asked what line therapy. They say first line. So where are we today with RET rearrangements in terms of first-line therapy and choice of agent, Solange?
I fully agree with the majority of the voting people. I think now these two agents, I wouldn't like to compare one with the other one. I think they are pretty similar in the how they are active and also in terms of toxicity safety profile. Selpercatinib and pralsetinib are very good drugs and they enter this category of frontline treatments of these TKIs, which give a range of response, which is way above 50%, 60 plus, which are brain penetrance for as an important characteristic, maybe a little less in RET than in ALK or in ROS, but still, this very advanced disease will at some point go to the brain and can be really given on a daily basis for 1 year, 2 years, 3 years with an acceptable, even a good quality of life. So these two drugs, and without comparing them again, enter this category of obviously frontline strategy. On the other hand, if you would like to give chemo frontline, the problem will be the question of IO. All of these patients almost are never smokers. And we know these never smokers really benefit, if any benefit is seen, at a very small extent, with very few benefit from IO. So I think there's no very good frontline strategy using chemo or chemo IO. So really, it's TKI first for these patients, right?
So Zosha, these are a couple of slides from Solange's talk. And again, I really recommend that you check out, you know, kind of painting a picture in terms of driver alterations. Just kind of curious, Zosha, do you send or would you recommend a general oncologist sending any kind of genomic assays on patients with squamous or mixed adenosquamous, Zosha?
I think it's certainly a reasonable thing to consider. I think, you know, right now the guidelines say to consider it particularly in patients who have, or you're not your typical squamous patient, you know, never smokers or light smokers, younger patients. I will say, you know, these alterations rarely can happen in squamous tumors. We certainly see EGFR, ALK. I actually had a KRAS G12C patient in a squamous tumor. So I think more and more, it's probably very reasonable and I think increasingly important to genotype all non-small cell lung cancers, regardless of histology. I think, you know, the downsides are low. And if you pick up a few patients that may have better treatment options, I think that the potential for benefit is high.
Mm-hmm. So let's go on to another case. This is a patient of Dr. Gigi Chen, a 66-year-old woman. We're going to talk a little bit about EGFR. This patient has EGFR exon 19 deletion, PD-L1 60%. And Solange says ignore that because of the presence of this driver mutation. This patient, interestingly, and again, once you start getting into the real world, you deal with situations like this one where the patient did not want to receive chemotherapy. And so she actually ended up on osimertinib, initially started on erlotinib, got switched to osimertinib, had a nice response, wanted for quite a while, then had disease progression, and the patient didn't want chemo. So she sort of spot welded. This is the only area of progression. She radiated it. And now it's a year later and she's progressing again. Here's Dr. Chen.
About a year and a half later, developed right lower lobe lung mass progression. The rest of the disease was stable. Her wishes were to avoid chemotherapy for as long as possible. So she underwent SBRT to the lung lesion. Now that we're another year out, at this time, what would be the best course of treatment? You know, would additional SBRT be reasonable? And could that offer her another year of disease-free interval? Or would people recommend changing to chemotherapy? And what kind of chemotherapy option would be the best if we were to change to chemotherapy? Mm-hmm. Another question is that since the osimertinib has a good role in terms of preventing brain metastasis, what would be the role of continuing with the osimertinib if we were to change her treatment to chemotherapy?
So, Greg, you know, a lot of these principles that we're talking about, we talk about it in one target, but, you know, people are applying them across the different targeted therapies for better or worse, often a lack of data. What about this strategy of oligoprogression and treating oligoprogression locally as this patient was once and maybe what's going to happen again? Any thoughts about that strategy, Greg?
You know, I think this is really our key approach in these patients because we really want to get every bit of benefit out of these TKIs that we can. And I think there's not the greatest prospective data that addresses this, but there's a fair amount of retrospective data that tells us that if we target single sites of progression, we're able to continue the TKI longer, just like we saw in this case. You know, she's able to continue on the TKI for another year after that local therapy. And, you know, I think every case is different. And, you know, in a particular patient like this who really wants to avoid platinum doublet chemotherapy, I think it's reasonable to continue to use local therapies. The art comes in trying to make sure that we don't wait too long and that the patient's performance status doesn't decline in a way that would make chemotherapy too difficult for them.
So, Solange, the other question that was posed there, and I'm actually going to ask the audience this. So audience, so let's make it a little more simple. You got a patient who's on osimertinib, they respond, and now they have systemic progression. Let's say no brain mets, okay? We're going to talk about brain mets in a second. So my question is, you're going to switch to, let's say, chemotherapy and no targetable lesions. Maybe you're going to use an IO. But my question is, would you consider, as was brought up by Dr. Chen, keeping the osimertinib going to try to protect the brain at least temporarily? I'm curious, audience, is that a strategy that you employ? And Solange, actually, interestingly, more than three quarters of the audience says yes. I'm curious, do you continue osimertinib in the face of progression to protect the brain, Solange?
Yes. So when you observe a systemic progression under osimertinib, the risk for the brain is very high. So it means that at some point you will hit the situation where a brain relapse will happen. So how to protect the brain? Of course, the most obvious thing to do is to continue OZ and to put on the top chemo. Very interesting strategy. It's feasible in terms of safety profile, but it is not supported at all by any control data. So even small series are not really showing that it should be done. But it makes sense in terms of daily practice. So many, many people do it, particularly in the US, because you have the opportunity sometimes to do that. In Europe, we see it differently. We try to protect the brain with IO. So for most of these patients, a physician will decide to switch, to stop the OZ, and to switch to chemo, but not only chemo, but chemo IO, which would probably mean a regimen like carboplatin, pemetrexed, and pembrolizumab, or even more, you know, the four-drug regimen of paclitaxel, carboplatin, atezolizumab, and bevacizumab, like was done in IMpower 150, because it looks like bevacizumab had some components, particularly in EGFR-mutated tumor. So that would be the European perspective, also because of limitations we might have, and because it might be slightly more supported by data. In the European perspective, of course, we will probably recirculate or rechallenge a TKI, an EGFR TKI later down the road. So we probably would better rechallenge the TKI later on than continuing it. But I agree with you. The brain is a question mark when you switch to chemotherapy. You have to do chemo probably plus something.
So we'll get to the brain in a second, but Zosha, a great question in the chat room, again, goes way beyond EGFR. Swati wants to know, do IOs work in patients with EGFR tumor mutations? And really introducing the whole issue of the use of IOs in people with targeted lesion. Do you approach them all the same? What about somebody who's a smoker and a BRAF? IOs in patients with targetable mutations, Zosha?
It's a really important point, and I think your point is well taken, Neil, that we can't consider all of these mutations probably, you know, the same in this situation. I think we are going to have to be more granular. I think, you know, the question here specifically about EGFR mutations, and I think, you know, similarly, we can lump in ALK and RUS1 here as well, but the most data we have is about EGFR, and the short answer is immunotherapy as monotherapy seems to have pretty limited benefit for these patients. You know, we saw meta-analysis of the single agent immunotherapy studies versus docetaxel, and the EGFR mutant population was really the one group that benefited more from chemotherapy than any of the PD-1 or PD-L1 checkpoint inhibitors. But I think that, you know, there remains to be seen what the role of chemo IO for these patients will be. And importantly, again, you know, I think we can't necessarily extrapolate from that to some of the other, particularly smoking, mutations more commonly seen in smokers like KRAS and BRAF, where we have seen some retrospective data that responses to immunotherapy are more common.
So Greg, you get to handle the most common question we get about targeted therapy is what do you do about the brain? And we're going to present a case in a second. But before that, I just want to ask the audience, have you used a targeted agent, for example, osimertinib, to treat brain mets without radiation therapy, audience? Have you done that? Have you used that strategy? You have a patient with brain mets, particularly if they're, you know, asymptomatic. Have you treated a patient like that just with targeted therapy? And actually, more than half of the audience has already done that. Here's another case. This is Dr. Regina Flores. She has a 70-year-old woman also is presenting with liver, bone, and brain mets. And she actually initiated osimertinib in spite of the brain mets, and the patient's responding, doing well. But here are her questions.
A 70-year-old diabetic male with EGFR L858R stage 4 lung cancer with liver, bone, brain metastasis was started on osimertinib. This is just a fresh case. What would prompt you to radiate the brain up front instead of just waiting it out after starting osimertinib? Does degree of vasogenic edema, size or location of brain metastases, or seizure activity influence your decision? Because, you know, we wait on radiating up front now with these medications because they could cross a blood-brain barrier. But I was just curious if, you know, let's say you had a big cerebellar metastases or a lot of vasogenic edema, or how many brain metastases, does that matter as far as postponing radiation? I did send him to radiation doctor who basically said, just treat him and then we'll just repeat an MRI in 3 months.
And Greg, it's amazing how many cases we hear of patients who get sent to a radiation oncologist for brain mets. Mm-hmm. And then the radiation oncologist says, hey, you need an NGS. I'm sending you back to the oncologist. So Greg, we could, again, spend a lot of time. I think we did a whole symposium on this at the big neuro meeting. Yeah. The art and science of treating brain mets in people with targetable lesions. Greg, your thoughts.
You know, I think there's two key factors that come into play. One is, you know, do you have the NGS or the mutation results fast enough to make this decision? You know, I saw a patient on Friday, young guy, never smoker, head full of brain metastases, and I don't have mutation results. And I'm really struggling with what to do because I know it's going to take me a week or two to get results. The guy with the radiation oncologist is ready to roll anytime. So it's a tough balance. I really want to try to hold off if I can. And so if I can render the patient asymptomatic with steroids, then I'm going to start them on TKI. Now, the role of radiation can be, it's a little bit easier to think about if, say, you have two brain metastases, three brain metastases. It's to me, it's a very straightforward decision if your only opportunity is whole brain radiation therapy versus TKI. You're going to go with TKI. It's probably got a higher likelihood of success for the brain, and it lets you treat the whole body at the same time. So I think that's my decision making. When there are a couple spots, it's a harder decision, but I'll typically begin with just the TKI. And if I haven't seen the response I want, then we bring in the radiation folks.
So Zosia, one situation that's very important that we don't have any case on, but you covered in your talk, and I just want to bring up because I think it's so important and actually so interesting, which is exon 20 alterations and mutations, another type of EGFR, but very different, and the approach being very different. Can you talk about these mutations in general and what we know right now about how they can be treated?
Yeah, it's a great point. You know, I think the first thing is to recognize these as something unique and different from other types of EGFR mutations. And this pie chart kind of illustrates that. You know, I think now we have to be granular in distinguishing different types of EGFR mutations that we see in our NGS reports and distinguishing the most common and most sensitive mutations, the exon 19 deletions and L858R mutations that are the sensitizing mutations that we typically treat with osimertinib. There are the atypical but still sensitizing mutations like the G719 mutations. And then the exon 20 insertions, which are the third most common type of EGFR mutation that we see and historically haven't been responsive to targeted therapies when we only had first generation EGFR inhibitors available. There's now a number of drugs in development, both TKI-based therapies, and actually now, you know, this has come into the limelight because they're the first approval for EGFR exon 20 insertions came through with amivantamab, which is the bispecific antibody to EGFR and MET. And with amivantamab, you know, we see a response rate of 40%. We see a progression-free survival of 8.3 months. I think, you know, really quite promising data. I think this is a really great treatment options for patients with exon 20 insertions. It's approved second line or later, but it still leaves open the question of what the optimal TKI therapy for these patients will be. And there's a number of different TKIs in clinical trials that are showing, you know, I would say promising results. There's been some challenges with balancing efficacy and activity with these different TKIs, poziotinib, mobocertinib, and others, but you know, I think more to come on that. And the important thing, the key thing is just to recognize exon 20 insertions as something different than other types of EGFR mutations, not to reflexively start first-line osimertinib for these patients, but think about potentially referring them for clinical trials or maybe thinking about chemotherapy first-line and amivantamab as a second-line option for the label right now.
So again, you can check out Zosia's talk. I showed some of the slides that she presented. They're so fascinating. Just one question, though, about the bispecific. Of course, the concept of bispecific we've been hearing about in hematologic cancers, such a fascinating concept. What do you see in terms of tolerability issues with this agent, Zosia?
So I think the most important, the most common side effects to be aware of are a fairly high rate of infusion-related reactions, which seem to be most common on cycle one, day one. There's actually split dosing on with the first infusion between cycle one, day one, and day two. Many of these infusion reactions are low grade, grade one or two, and manageable with supportive care. And then patients, even if they do have a reaction, are able to go on to be treated. But it is important to counsel patients and be very mindful of that. The other big one is skin toxicities, which we've seen with monoclonal antibodies against EGFR. And I think, you know, same effects here. But generally, I think, you know, fairly well-tolerated drugs. Of course, it's an infusion, you know, it requires coming to clinic, which is a downside compared to TKI-based option. But I think it really is a good option to have.
So we're going to go on now and talk about another targeted case. A couple more. We're going to hear a case from Dr. Ray Lovins again. This is a 62-year-old woman who actually has HER2 mutant lung cancer, adenocarcinoma of the lung. Solange, I'm going to ask you for your thoughts about this case. Here's Dr. Lovins.
She'd run out of all of the normal non-small cell lung cancer regimens, and then she started having some flow effusions. Then she started developing some low EF of 25 to 30% from the trastuzumab and has renal insufficiency with a creatinine of 2.5 to 3. And so I'm not sure of what the data is with trastuzumab, taroxacan, and heart failure. I'm not sure if it will have the same toxicities and limitations as regular trastuzumab. I think it was a DESTINY trial maybe that came out looking at trastuzumab, taroxetican. Where should I have put it? Because I put it way down the list of the medications regimens that she had, and should I have moved it way up front?
So, of course, Solange, we're talking about TDXD, of course, of breast cancer and GI cancers, both CRC as well as gastric cancer, where it's approved in both breast and gastric. But also, we see some very interesting results in lung cancer. This patient actually has HER2 mutant disease. Out of sort of desperation, he had like 7 lines of therapy, actually tried trastuzumab with gemcitabine, and the patient dropped their ejection fraction, which brought up this question of, would you know anything about cardiac effects of TDXD? The patient also had some renal insufficiency. So maybe you can chat a little bit about what we know about this fascinating drug, Solange, and theoretically, based on what we know right now, where you think it fits in the algorithm.
Yeah, thanks a lot. We were a little desperate with HER2 mutations. These mutations share the biology of EGFR exon 20 insertion, but they don't share the same drug sensitivity. For example, while MOBO might be used in EGFR, it doesn't look to be active in HER2 and so on and so forth. So you need to really, we try to customize treatment for HER2 mutations, and we were only partially successful, right? We have been trying trastuzumab. I've seen data with pertuzumab, trastuzumab in analogy to breast. We've been trying T-DM1, you remember, based on mutation, based on immunohistochemistry. It gave some activity, but nothing which looks like a frontline strategy, maybe a second or third line. And of course, most of these alterations are found in never smokers, meaning that immunotherapy is not the main key player there. So a little desperate situation until trastuzumab deruxtecan. It's the first time a drug meets this famous threshold of potentially being a frontline strategy. More than 60% kind of response rate, an acceptable durability of the response, and also a tolerability, which is in line with long-term exposure to patients. So I think for the first time, and of course, DESTINY is now moving to larger sample size, at least in Europe, and controlled data to be eligible for frontline decision, but to meet the frontline treatment. The problem with this drug is not cardiac toxicity, which was not described as being a main, I would say, concern in breast or in lung or in gastric, but the potential lung toxicity, which was observed first in breast and now is also being observed in gastric and in some lung cancer patients. The lung toxicity is variable across diseases, but is the one you have to be concerned about. Of course, you will tell me provocatively, but this patient with heart insufficiency have probably been excluded from the trials. The answer is yes. This patient with heart insufficiency have been excluded from the inclusion into the trials. So I would say we still don't know. But basically and biologically, I would potentially in such a patient try to expose him to the drug with a very close follow-up of the heart cardiac the cardiac function, which is very easy to assess, I must say. We are all used to do that in breast cancer. So it's something which can be followed up over time. But it's not the main concern of the drug today.
So, Zosia, any thoughts or experiences with TDXD? I know there's any evidence there's any kind of cardiac problem the way we see with the other anti-HER drug. Would you have any concerns about giving it to this patient? And very curious about what your thoughts and feelings are about the ILD also, Zosia.
Yeah, I agree completely with Solange in that, you know, I think we really don't have, you know, patients with pre-existing cardiac toxicities probably, you know, weren't included in clinical trials. So it's hard to extrapolate clinical trial data to a patient like that. And I think, you know, it would be reasonable to consider treating that patient, but I think, you know, would obviously have to be done in careful collaboration with a cardiologist, with close monitoring of cardiac function, et cetera, because I think the truth is we really don't know for a patient with underlying heart disease, you know, how safe that would be. I think in general, I am also very enthusiastic about the efficacy that we've seen with this agent. I think it's really a great option for our HER2 patients, but I think the ILD is a real concern. You know, I think the fortunate thing is that pneumonitis is something that we're used to dealing with, and you know, we see it with so many different types of lung cancer therapies, but it is an important one to counsel patients about and to monitor closely for and to be aware of so that, you know, you can pick up on it early if it does occur.
So Greg, just kind of curious again, putting reimbursement issues aside, as Solange was saying, you know, sort of the IPASS bar that we've talked about having response rates of 60%, looks like TDXD, that waterfall plot looks pretty impressive in all these cancers, but then you've got the ILD out there. And it's interesting how the different tumor types, everybody's concerned about it. I kind of find that the lung people aren't as concerned, maybe because you all deal with so many lung problems already. But Greg, any thoughts, any experience seeing useful responses in your practice?
You know, I definitely have seen great responses. I think, you know, the thing that stands out about the data that we've seen so far is the response rate, as Solange mentioned, and as she also mentioned, the duration of response. You know, median progression-free survivals of 18 months really tell me that this is likely to be a valuable strategy. You know, it's probably going to follow the usual path and be approved as a second line agent first, and then we'll start exploring it in the first line. But it's a, you know, it's a remarkable suggestion of benefit. And I look forward to seeing more utilization.
Curious too, Greg, because you know the other tumors we talked about, breast and the GI cancers, you're looking at overexpression and amplification. And here we're talking about HER2 mutant. So what's the ratio? What's the fraction of people with lung who have mutant versus amplification, Greg? And does T-DXd work differently in those two populations in lung?
That's a really important thing to highlight, because we don't have as much data about HER2 amplification in lung cancer as a target for these drugs. There's ongoing studies, and we've seen a little bit of data presented thus far, but the majority of the data is really with HER2 mutations. And again, that's distinct from what we see in breast cancer, what we see in other diseases. So this is about mutations rather than gene expression or gene copy number or amplification, any of that sort of thing. This is looking at HER2 mutations. Interestingly, they're in the same exon 20 that we see in EGFR. It's HER2 exon 20.
So, Solange, we have one more case. This is a patient of Dr. Sulfie Ibrahim, a 46-year-old woman, and here's the case.
It took me about an hour for me to convince this lady to go on the CodeBreaK 100 study. She got sotorasib. It's 18 months later. She still has disease, but it's significantly improved. She still remains on sotorasib, basically with no toxicity from the drug, and she has responded well to therapy. So my questions are, sotorasib, I think at this time, is approved as a second-line therapy for patients with the KRAS G12C mutations. In the future, is this something that may be moved up to the frontline setting, like, say, osimertinib is for EGFR mutations? Is there any concern about a patient who received sotorasib a few months after the completion of immunotherapy? Is there a risk of increased pneumonitis, as there is in patients who receive osimertinib after receiving immunotherapy? And lastly, is there any data regarding the CNS activity of this drug?
So Solange, you know, the docs, they hear the story and then they realize it's going to apply to other forms of targeted therapy. So Dr. Ibrahim brings up some general questions. I should mention that this patient actually had a relapse only a few months after getting consolidation durvalumab, which sparked his question about whether or not you see sort of the phenomena we were talking about before. I was kind of surprised. This patient had a response for 18 months. I don't know if that's typical or not, but that seems pretty impressive. So, Solange, your thoughts about the future of management of KRAS G12C and sotorasib?
Yeah, so first of all, don't take me wrong. I think that the emergence of these KRAS inhibitors is a revolution, right? We couldn't believe in that. We all pretended for years that it will never happen. And now the drug designers were able to build this kind of evidences and will improve that over time. So don't take me wrong, it's a revolution. However, these drugs have not passed my threshold for frontline strategy, right? They still give rise to some months of PFS, around 7, and a response rate around 40%. KRAS is one of these alterations which gives rise to specific sensitivity to IO. So here, when you give chemo IO, suddenly you really gain a lot of efficacy and you really win in terms of frontline strategy. So frontline strategy for a KRAS for me is still chemo IO. And by the way, the companies are seeking to imagine frontline combinations, right? Because you need probably to make the threshold a little higher using this drug, being adagrasib or sotorasib frontline. Does sotorasib has brain activity? We haven't seen this data. I would have some doubts about it, because usually when you have brain activity, you have lots of slides showing the brain activity. So I suppose it's not completely obvious. And I would say some of my chemist colleagues would tell me that maybe the molecule is not completely penetrating the brain. So I'm not so sure about it. It looks like maybe adagrasib has some data about brain, but I haven't seen a large series today. Compatibility with IO, same answer. We still don't know. We haven't seen the data. At least we haven't seen lots of toxicity when it follows IO. But this doesn't mean it can be combined with IO, because suddenly you have hepatitis and this kind of toxicity. So we're still waiting for the potential combinations to come for this agent with IO. I have seen early phase one trial of the adagrasib, early phase one, two trials attempts being ongoing. I haven't seen any data with sotorasib until now. So I would say evidence to come, but it is to me a second line treatment strategy still as monotherapy.
So actually, Greg, Sonia in the chat rooms asked, would adagrasib, which Solange just mentioned, be a better choice as first line or as initial anti-KRAS strategy? And actually, in your talk, you showed this waterfall plot. What do we know about this other agent, Craig?
Yeah, adagrasib is another direct KRAS G12C inhibitor. And we see response rates that you see here, 43%, 45% in a couple different populations. You know, this is, again, early data. It's based on the same type of data that was shown for sotorasib. We have no comparative data, so we can't really tell you which one is better versus the other, but certainly provocative findings for both sotorasib and this newer drug, adagrasib, which is still unapproved.